Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I'm Doug Tribou, in for Bill Littlefield, who's on vacation this week. In the winter of 1941, Seattle's minor league baseball team was looking for a manager. The applicants included Rogers Hornsby, Grover Cleveland Alexander, and Babe Ruth. Five of the 13 men who attempted to land the job would eventually wind up in the Baseball Hall of Fame. In his new book, Pitchers of Beer, The Story of the Seattle Rainiers, Dan Raley chronicles the rise and fall of a team that attracted more fans than some of its big league counterparts. I began our conversation by asking Raley to tell the story of why a minor league baseball team that's been defunct for nearly 50 years means so much to him.
When I was 9 years old, I lived in a city called Port Angeles, which was about 2.5 hours out of Seattle. And my father was the commissioner of the Olympic National Park, which was like a federal judge. And he took me to see the Rainiers. They came up there to play an exhibition game, and he took the whole family. And then, sadly, the following day in 1963, he was killed in a fairly spectacular car accident. So my last memories of my father were at a ballpark watching the Seattle Rainiers play. And my mother took myself and my brother and sister, moved us back to Seattle where she was from. And one of the things I did to divert my attention away from a tragic family shakeup was I would go to Sick Stadium and watch the Rainiers play, and I loved every minute of it.
Emil Sick bought the franchise in 1937. Sick was a brewer and a sharp businessman. He paid a San Francisco brewery $1.5 million for the naming rights to Rainier Beer, then immediately changed the team name to match. Why was Sick so well-suited to running a baseball team?
Well, this was the post-Depression era, and a lot of people were in recovery, kind of like the current day. And he was one of the few people that had money. In those down times, people still had to have alcohol coming out of Prohibition and Depression, and he made it available. At one time, he was the leading brewer in the world. He had breweries all over Canada, and he was based out of Seattle, and so he had money to spend, and he decided to spend it on baseball.
The Rainiers' first manager, Jack Lelavelt, died in 1941. Babe Ruth was mentioned as a possible successor, but the home run king sent word that he wasn't interested. Ruth soon changed his mind and lobbied hard for the job. Why didn't Sick go with the sport's biggest name?
Well, Babe Ruth turned him down. Babe Ruth was sick. You know, he'd been discarded from, you know, a coaching job in the majors and unable to get a managing job because of his free-spirited reputation. And he was sick, and he said no thanks through his wife from New York. And then he thought about it, and he thought, you know, these people actually came to me and offered me this job, and he got all excited about it. And Sick had moved ahead, after the rejection. He needed a manager. Spring training was just around the corner, so Emil Sick went out and hired Bill Skiff, who was another former Yankee. I'm not sure Babe Ruth even remembered this guy because he played six games and had 11 at-bats, and so they made the hire, and then Babe Ruth calls up Emil Sick and says, I'm ready for that job. Emil, what do you say? And Emil says, I've given it away. So it was probably one of the greatest near misses in Seattle sporting history, bringing Babe Ruth to Seattle. He would have been, you know, wholeheartedly welcomed. It would have been fun. The teams didn't do very well when he wasn't hired, and so there was nothing to lose if they had hired him, and he might have died in Seattle and just changed the whole history of Babe Ruth and the Seattle itself.
In those early years of the franchise, Seattle wasn't the major city we think of today. You often mention the Rainiers' widespread popularity, at one point writing, quote, practically overnight, Rainiers baseball had woken up a depressed, slumbering town. How did a Pacific Coast League baseball team manage that?
Well, you know, Seattle's like the most far-flung city on the American continent, and, you know, just way out of reach from everything, from New York, from the East Coast, from Major League Baseball at that time. And the Pacific Coast League was a nice alternative, but it took over Seattle. You know, they had sports like University of Washington football and a couple other things, but nothing really to grab onto like this baseball team, you know, turned the city upside down and started packing the ballpark, started winning championships, and had some, you know, people that became heroes like Fred Hutchinson, who now is the International Cancer Center named after him in downtown Seattle that people come to. And so it just became, you know, a part of the fabric of Seattle, and it helped it become eventually a big league city.
Hutchinson's story is fascinating. He was a rookie with the Rainiers in 1938, and at the age of 19, went 25-7 with a 2.48 ERA. And then he went off to the majors for a fairly unspectacular big league career. He didn't return to the Rainiers until he became the manager in 1955. How did he become such an icon in Seattle?
Well, he had this magical season. Like you said, he was 25-7, and he couldn't lose, and people had to see him wherever he went, up and down the coast. They had the biggest crowds for him, and he was just, most of the season, this 18-year-old kid that just caught the whole coast by storm. And then, you know, he just developed a respect from all of that. He was from a family that was really ingrained in the city. His father was a doctor. His brother became a doctor, and so he went to the major leagues and had a decent major league career. He went to the All-Star game and pitched in it, but he became the manager of the Tigers. So the respect carried over wherever he went. He had that kind of personality, and so Seattle got him back after he left the Tigers in a contract dispute and made him manager. He came back twice actually, and then he ended up with the St. Louis Cardinals, and finally with the Cincinnati Reds, and took them to the World Series and died at the age of 45 from lung cancer, which, you know, gripped the nation's baseball fans. So the man had a lot of influence just with his persona.
You describe Rogers Hornsby as, quote, one of baseball's earliest Hall of Fame inductees, elite hitters, and overbearing egos. Emil Sick passed on hiring Hornsby in 1941, but did make him manager a decade later. Did Hornsby's method of removing pitchers pretty much sum up his treatment of his players?
Yes. For those curious to that one, Rogers would never leave the dugout. Unlike any other baseball manager, he would just point to the bullpen and wave a guy in. He was such a perfectionist or hard-edged guy that he didn't want to go out and talk to a pitcher on the mound that was struggling. So he had his own unique style.
I love that he restricted his pitchers from throwing sliders, referring to them as nickly curves.
Marv Grissom, who was a major league pitcher and made a living off that pitch, ignored him, and Rogers would argue with him about it, but Grissom won 20 games for him, so there's a little bit of mediation on it at that point.
Pitchers of Beer is loaded with behind-the-scenes baseball stories peppered with familiar names, and there are far too many for us to cover here, so I'd like to ask you to share one of your favorite Rainiers stories.
Well, the one I like the best is kind of blue, and it involves a man who is now a bank president in Seattle at Seattle Bank. His name is Pat Patrick. And back in 1956, he was a bat boy for the Seattle Rainiers, and he'd won a contest in the paper I used to work for in Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and he was named bat boy. And part of that job, he was given keys to everything in the stadium, and he was very curious about the stadium, and he liked to wander around and look at different nooks and crannies. And he noticed a stairway in a darkened hallway, and it was right near the first base dugout and right over the visitor's clubhouse, and He wondered what was in there, and so one day he took a set of keys and walked up there and unlocked the door and went in, and it was like a little apartment, and it had a couch, fold-out couch, and a little table and a bathroom, and it was a little studio apartment right in the middle of the stadium. And while he was up there, he heard steps coming up the stairway, and so he ducked behind the only thing that would hide him, and that was the couch, and in walked a Rainiers player that he knew, and accompanied by a woman that he didn't know, and this Pat Patrick, hiding behind the couch, had to keep quiet as personal relations took place. And his quote in the book, which is my favorite, was, "I was never more afraid and excited in my life." And he swore that he'd never tell the identity of the player. But he mentioned this, and the general manager found out, was outraged that this type of thing was going on. And what was happening was the team trainer was basically renting out the room to those players and making a little money on the side. And that man was fired on Monday.
And the apartment was really there for scouts and other visitors who were in town on more serious business.
Exactly. And they later filled it full of equipment, trying to discourage anybody from using it for anything other than baseball activity.
As Seattle grew and changed, baseball did the same. The Dodgers and Giants relocated from New York to California in 1958. The minor leagues were becoming less independent and ceding more control to major league organizations. What was the ultimate undoing of the Rainiers?
I would say the invasion of the major leagues, which was inevitable. I mean, you had all these people moving west, all these California cities that were starting to become major population centers, and we got, you know, airline travel, which Seattle was responsible for. We built the first jet airliners, and all of a sudden, the country changed in the 50s. So Seattle kind of got left behind at that point. They were still, you know, a step below San Francisco and Los Angeles, who drew the major league franchises that moved from, you know, New York City and Brooklyn. And so Seattle had to wait its turn. But that was the end of the Pacific Coast League for the Northwest, because it wanted to become a big league city. It had the World's Fair, and it was determined to have big league sports. And one by one, it got each one of those.
Dan Raley is the author of Pitchers of Beer, The Story of the Seattle Rainiers, which is published by the University of Nebraska Press. And he joined me from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Dan, thanks a lot.
Hey, Doug, thanks for having me.
This week on Only a Game, in addition to my conversation with Dan Raley, I'll talk with Yahoo Sports columnist and Only a Game regular Dan Wetzel, who contributed to Yahoo's expose on NCAA violations at the University of Miami. Also, Ron Schachter has the story of a men's tennis doubles team who double as activists promoting peace between India and Pakistan. Plus, Minneapolis Star Tribune reporter Lavelle E. Neal III will examine the career of twin slugger Jim Thome, who hit his 600th home run this week. Charlie Pierce will have his weekly take on the top and bottom stories in the world of sports, and I'll step out of my comfort zone and into Broga, a yoga class designed for dudes. Join us.